Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
And I'm joined this week by my good friend Jason Henricks. Jason, hi.
Broadcasting live, actually, from Sunrise Bank. I don't know if you remember the episode we had the CEO, Dave Reiling, on to talk about fintech for good. And I was fortunate I got to sit in on their advisory board. Let's just say it was a great reminder for me on the importance of community banks and the difference they can make in communities. We were in the Junior Achievement Office up here for the Upper Midwest, where they're teaching over 36,000 kids a year about entrepreneurship. Yeah. Maybe they need to do that too, but it was just fascinating to me, like the benefit, these kids are getting, a lot of them, from inner city, and where this is situated, with just this beautiful facility, great partnerships with a lot of the both big and small organizations where people come in and teach these kids about entrepreneurship and really are giving them a leg up on, upward mobility and starting their own business that hopefully they don't know check signing. But one of the interesting things they do teach is the basics of finance and how do you leverage financial technology.
There's been an argument that that should be taught in schools for years, basic managing your bank account, managing bills. It's a life skill, and we should teach some of these life skills in schools. But hey, listen, before we get to that, we're going to talk about core systems and how well that's developing, and we won't be talking about checks again, at least I hope not. But before we get to the show and we invite our guests, we've got a bit of news. Apple has come out warning people against storing their Apple Card in leather or denim, which probably discounts about half of the U.S. population, at least. You can't put it in a wallet. Isn't a wallet made out of leather?
I mean, the question is, where else do you store it? Because I'm like, do you have to get one of those duct tape wallets? What do you
do? No, they're setting this up for an accessory that goes on the back of your iPhone, which you can slip the card in. That's my guess. But
they also said don't put it near a magnet, Brett. And my experience, at least with my iPhone and hotel access keys, is you put your iPhone next to that access key, within a couple hours it's demagnetized. So I wonder how long that will last.
I don't know. In other news in the U.S., N26 has moved out of beta in the U.S., so that's big news for the American market. We've seen the news, Bank of America is talking about a huge surge in person-to-person mobile payments. Finally, it looks like the U.S. is starting to catch up a little bit on what's happening out in China. At the same time, Chase Pay shut down their app. So it looks like the embedded mobile wallets continue to show us the way. And Danish neobank Lunarway, I don't know if you heard of them, Jason, but they just raised €26 million this week. So another neobank enters the fray.
We both have been founders of neobanks, and Moovin is still moving ahead. Where do you think the open space is for, the neobank? And Penny, I'd love for you to jump in on this too, because it feels like it's getting awfully crowded, especially in Europe, where they have even more than in the U.S.
Penny Crosman, welcome back to the show. Penny Crosman, the editor-in-chief of American Banker, Bank Next. I mean, Bank Tech.
Thank you. Editor at large. I can't
editor at large, sorry.
For that promotion. That's okay. Thank you, though. That's a great question. I mean, they're certainly appealing to a younger demographic that I think that they're these neobanks are sort of easier to use. They're more mobile and have lower fees. The numbers of adoption are still relatively low in the U.S. The largest ones, even Chime, I believe, is at 4 million users, and Moneyline is also at 4 million users, and capital, I believe, is a $3 million. They're still growing, but they're not touching the big incumbent banks yet. So, but they certainly are, they're certainly getting a little bit of traction, and it is a crowded market, as you say. But I think, you know, it'll be kind of interesting to see how they add on, because I think they are adding interesting new features at a pretty rapid rate. Like N26, one of the things is early wage access. They give you access to your paycheck 2 days ahead.
Right, and Monzo just announced that today, too.
Okay, yeah, that's sort of an emerging thing that people want to have, I guess. And then there's some interesting perks. They're getting rewards from companies like Blinkist, the micro reading app, and Active, which is a fitness app. So sort of trying to latch on to trendy apps that they can partner with. Mm. You know, so it's still early days, but it does seem like they're getting the people who are disaffected by the traditional banks, people who've been, you know, have had a bad experience with their bank or just have a bad feeling about banks. I think they are, they're getting that crowd.
Well, you know, if you look at the traction that's happened in the UK market in particular, it started like that with the dissatisfaction with the traditional players. But then as soon as they got those sort of numbers, what started to happen is they started to get referral business and they started to get people saying, you know, this is so much better than the high street banks. And so now we see some real movement there. But listen, I think we'll come back to that discussion when we're talking about core, because maybe we should talk about the cores that N26 have. But before we get to that, we've got a few conference announcements, Jason, and then I've got one more piece of news before we jump into the core stuff. But on the conference announcements, let me handle the first couple of them. First of all, we've got Mobile Payments Conference coming up in Chicago. It's not far away now, 3 days away, August 26th to 28th. With a great lineup of commerce and payments experts ranging from Google, Pinterest, Venmo, and PayFi. You can use the code MPC19BB50. That's MPC19BB50, and Darshan will get you to tweet that out so everyone's got that. And Jason will be there doing a live recording.
A recap of what you and I did about 3 years ago now. Yeah, I'll be able to actually get to be the tough question asker of each of the keynotes after they finish. So look forward to that.
Well, we should see if we can play some of that on the show next week. Also coming up in, it's not far away now, just 1 month away, between September the 23rd and September the 26th, we have Sibos in London. Sibos is long known as one of the largest financial services conferences in the world, particularly for incumbent, traditional players. But the real action at Sibos happens at InnerTribe, the InnerTribe stage. This year we have Professor Brian Cox, the astrophysicist, doing the opening for InnerTribe. It's going to be super interesting. He's sort of a rock star in the space. And inimitable Dave Birch and myself will be closing InnerTribe. And we're going to do a piece on what sci-fi tells us about the future of money. So that should be pretty interesting. But there's a couple more conferences coming up in October also, Jason, right?
Yeah, well, JP and I are running part of the BAI Innovation Summit October 8th through 10th in Boston. And you know, one of the things that, you know, as much as we like talking about the shiny objects in the future of sci-fi, the reality for most banks is how do we actually drive tangible value? And so we're doing an immersive hands-on session around how do you actually take an empirical approach to value creation to really maximize the results and minimize wasted effort. So think of this as Steve Blank and Eric Ries meets banking for a lot of banks that hadn't been exposed to it. And so if you go to BAI, that's BravoAlphaIndia.org, you can save $300 if you use the code S19, that's Sierra19er. The other conference, and this is actually one of my favorites that's in Chicago, is Solstice Forward 19. And Solstice many might not know, is a design firm that has done a lot around experience in digital and a lot within financial services. And I don't want to say who their client list is, but if you go and look at who their speakers are, about half of them come from financial services. And I love how they, kind of like you and Birch, are going to be talking about what sci-fi can teach us. They do a really good job of pulling together other industries and saying, hey, what can you learn about financial services by looking at disruption in other places? And so you can register at solstice.com/FWD19 and use the code FINTEX, FINTEX, for 50% off. Brett, you want to do the last one?
Yeah, so competing with Cybos in London is Finovate Fall in New York. So don't miss your chance to join 1,500 financial and banking executives, venture capitalists, innovators, entrepreneurs, industry analysts, and more in New York to drive the financial industry forward. Now, they'll be coming from all across the globe to hear from industry leaders, see the latest fintech innovations, all in their special 7-minute demo format. And you get the opportunity to network with innovators and executives behind the emerging tech in banking and finance. You can use the code, and this one's a tough one, FKV2348BDW. We're going to have to tweet that out. That's Foxtrot Kilo Victor 234 Bravo, sorry, 8 Bravo Delta Whiskey for 20% off. So there is a discount code, but we will definitely tweet that out. Now, before we.
Brett, I'm just going to say go to @BreakingBanks1 on Twitter and get the discount code there.
Exactly.
You lost me somewhere around Victor there.
Yeah, okay. But the news that I thought would be really interesting, and Penny, I'd love to get your comment on this as well. And I actually picked this up from a tweet from Paul Krugman. Which, you know, obviously Paul is sometimes a little controversial. But he tweeted out a tweet earlier today from Lawrence H. Summers. Now, he was the Charles W. Eliot Professor and President Emeritus at Harvard. He was the Secretary of the Treasury for President Clinton and the Director of the National Economic Council for President Obama. So he should know something about this. But he said that with the what's happening right now in terms of the economy, that economists are grappling with a major issue. And the Bitcoin guys are going to love this. And his question is, can central banking as we know it be the primary tool of macroeconomic stabilization in the industrial world over the next decade? And in his forthcoming paper, he argues this is in doubt. Now, this is a huge shift in the way we think about managing monetary policy. If central banks are no longer the mechanism for stabilizing the economy under pressure of something like a recession, then how do we stop a recession? Maybe the last successful central bank action was in fact, during the Obama administration taking action against the global financial crisis. Maybe the days of central bank control are over. Maybe that's what Lawrence Summers is hinting at. I can't wait to read that paper because that's super interesting. It would change everything we think of in respect to the role of central banks. Penny, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, there's a simple, easy question to answer. that's a huge, huge thing. I mean, I would think, you know, people at the Federal Reserve in the United States would argue vehemently that the Fed still has tremendous control in our treasury and our control of the currency as well. They certainly have control over the basic Fed funds rate and, you know, our basic interest rate situation. I mean, obviously there's very interesting things happening with cryptocurrency and the cryptocurrency markets just keep growing. And that is all out of the control of the central banks. I mean, on that front, I think eventually we'll see central banks issue their own cryptocurrency. But
well, there's rumors about China doing that, isn't there? Or looking at it, at least. There's rumors China are looking at that.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, that would, the more crypto takes off, the more that takes control away from the central banks. clearly. And certainly there are a lot of forces that are weakening the central bank's grip, but they're still pretty powerful. I mean, here we all kind of watch the Fed and the yield curve, and that it rocks the stock markets every time there's a change. So I guess, as you say, the paper would be fascinating, but I doubt it would happen anytime soon.
Mm. Now, I mean, speaking of centralized control, the topic of today's show is really around not central banking, but core banking, specifically the cores in the role they play. And you know, just as we talk about the kind of authoritarian tight grip that the central bank can exert, I think the majority of banks from small to large and across the world often talk about the strong grip that the core banks have played. And just as the central banks are changing, the cores are starting to feel the pressure, this time not as much from cryptocurrency, but an evolving landscape, not just of the fintech startups, but what's changing behind the scenes as there's a move towards cloud, there's a move towards APIs, the impact of PSD2. And so on today's show, we have actually two of my favorite pundits on the subject. First, Santo Cannone, and like, Santo, first, welcome, but you know, I don't know anyone who has worked for, I think you've touched every major core, is that right?
That's about right, Jason, it is.
And if you don't know him, so I got to know Santo when he was at Open Solutions, went with the acquisition to Fiserv, focused on the community banking and the credit union space. Before that, also spent time at FIS. What am I missing there, Santo? Who else did you work for besides those three?
Back in the 90s, I worked for a company that was acquired by EDS. So I spent about 5 years with EDS when they were trying to play in the community bank and credit union space as well.
Well, do you ever work on Hogan?
I fortunately never worked on Hogan.
There you go.
Yeah,
I got one they haven't worked with.
Yeah, and he dreams in cobalt still. But he's one of my favorites in terms of, you know, much to my wife's chagrin, I spend too much time thinking about core banking systems and regulation and how it impacts innovation. Santo probably spends more time thinking about those subjects, so it's great to have him. And the other who has deep roots within banking and especially within innovation is a leader of a new core called Neocova, and excited to have Sultan Meji here, who's CEO and co-founder. And you know, one of my favorite parts of Sultan's background is, what was your first experience, Sultan, in working in technology back at the University of Illinois when working on your PhD?
Well, I was an AI researcher, and I dabbled on the first web browser.
Yeah, so dabbled on the first web browser.
I go back all the way.
Yeah, you go back all of the way. And so, Santo, I want to tee this up, and just as Penny, you know, got the first tough question, I'm going to give her the second tough question right after this. But are we reaching an inflection point within core banking? With, you know, there's lots of talk of the large cores, they're not even startup cores, coming out of Europe, because the European banks that have U.S. presence are also, you know, big players here, and they've realized the benefits of open banking and APIs. You've got people like Citi and BBVA building entire ecosystems around it. Like, have we reached that zenith moment that, you know, the time of the big core is dead?
Yeah, Jason, I do think we're getting there. And I think what's underneath all of that is a lot of the conversation we've been having till now, which is, you know, if you're a community banker, I think your primary problem right now is relevance, right? How is it that you're going to show up in your communities that you're trying to serve, where people look to you for some sort of financial solutions? And clearly, these monolithic, slow-moving cores are very, very difficult. It's very difficult to match that up with the type of speed or responsiveness you need in order to be relevant to your market. So I do think we're getting to that point. I think clearly, as it has always been the case in the community bank and credit union space in the U.S., it's going to take somebody jumping out and jumping on one of the innovators and proving that they can be successful with it. And then I think we'll see some significant movement. And there's, you know, there's clearly some players right now that are showing some promise. Sultan's efforts, I think, are interesting. The Finastra group is certainly interesting. Nimbus has certainly made a lot of noise, and they appear to be making some progress. So, you know, the question's going to be who's going to break out of that pack with a significant signing and some demonstrable success, and then I think we see things starting to change.
I think this is where we see a divergence between what's already happening in China and sort of the rate of change in the U.S. And I think part of that is, you know, it's been pushed by Alipay and the real-time payments. And of course, you know, I don't know if we've talked much about FedNow and you know, the real-time payments now being shifted well past 2020 by the U.S. But you've got banks like China Minsheng Bank and you know, of course, WeBank, who have invested a ton in blockchain augmentation of their core systems. China Minsheng handles you know, forfeiting, letters of credit, other stuff like that already through blockchain. This is stuff that previously would have been you know, a module or a component of the core system. So I think this is another good example of where you know, we see some really interesting changes.
So, Penny, I'm curious, you're out there talking to both the banks and, you know, the technology providers, both incumbents and startups. And Brett brings up this really interesting point. You know, it's coming from both the East and from the West in terms of what especially Chinese banks have done and what the Europeans have done under PSD2. Do you think most banks in this country are aware of that pressure, and how are they responding to it?
To PSD2 specifically, the open banking?
Well, I mean, that as, you know, just the
General pressure.
Pressure towards, you know, the core is about to get disrupted.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I think pretty much every bank CIO in this country longs to have a modern core, you know, for as you guys have been saying, the ability to be nimble, the ability to partner with fintechs, the ability to launch new products quickly, the ability to go to real-time payments, like you were saying. You know, even Zelle is real-time payments now. So there's definite pressure on everybody to upgrade. But of course, as you know, the challenges are huge. It's a huge project to convert a core system, and it's considered very risky. You know, there was a big project Union Bank did. I think it started in 2009, where they tried to convert to Infosys Pinnacle, and the project fell apart, and the CIO left the company, and it was a very high profile kind of crash and burn. And I think for several years, a lot of banks just said, whoa, we're not touching that. And
yeah, we saw similar with Westpac in Australia.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so people are very skittish. The thing is, you know, as you guys were saying, it's like the heart of a human being, or like the engine of a car. Everything's got to work perfectly, and it's got to work from day one. So as I think you were saying, Jason, I think there's a lot of interest in some of the newer systems that have come out that are more modular, that are more cloud friendly, that are APIs, you know, meet API standards so that you could easily plug and play with other things. However, I think everybody's waiting for somebody else to take the plunge and actually go live with it and see how that works out for them before they, like, no one wants to be the first adopter. Everybody wants to be an early follower or a late follower. So,
especially when it comes to spending $1 billion on a core replacement, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And even, you know, BBVA took the plunge several years ago. They took a they converted to an Accenture system called Alnova, and they spent over $360 million on it. But it, you know, that's a big hit on your expenses,
yeah.
And I think it can be hard to immediately point to benefits, because some of this stuff is really under the hood, and eventually there's all kinds of benefits, but it takes time to feel and see the benefits of it. And then, of course, regulatory. You know, I remember with Union Bank hearing behind the scenes that the system at that time didn't have full compliance with U.S. regulations, and that's what brought it down. So that's another thing that you know, where the I's have to be dotted and the T's have to be crossed. So, you know, it's like everybody wants it, but everybody's extremely wary of the whole thing. And, it, you know, and the other thing is sometimes CIOs and CEOs, they're in that job for 2 to 4 years, you know, and a core project could take 6 years or longer. So there isn't necessarily the incentive to take the risk, take the big expense cut, because somebody else might, you know, achieve the glory. I know that's sort of, that's probably I don't know, world-weary take on it, but I think it's hard for executives to have the incentive, the motivation to
I agree.
Put their companies through that.
I agree. Santo, you have any comments?
Thanks, Brett. I do think Penny's raising a really good point. Now, I'll bring that down to the mid-tier institutions who are used to consuming products with some services. And clearly, as we begin to think about how these technologies are going to be deployed, a lot more services, which means a lot more risk. And I do think that's going to be a hurdle to widespread adoption at the mid-tier level in the U.S. The idea that I'm going to pay maybe a dollar for the software or the access to the software, maybe four for services, is really going to be hard for a lot of U.S. buyers to understand, and the associated risk, I think, will be an impediment. So that's, I think that's an area where we've got to see some improvement or some translation that makes the buyers more readily accepting of that idea.
Okay. Well, I think you're right. I think there's you know, what you don't get in the U.S., which you sometimes get in these other jurisdictions, is you get regulatory pressure for this. I don't think we're there yet, as you're sort of alluding to. But, Jason?
Well, what that made me think of is, so if you look to what the Chinese players, they were tech companies that were moving into the banking, so they were tech savvy in what they were doing. The EU gave it the regulatory mandate, but also doesn't have the proliferation of small banks that the U.S. does. And something that Santo just said that kind of struck me, I wonder if part of the reason we don't see the pressure in the U.S. from the regulators is, I don't know that most of, you know, the even mid-tier banks down to community banks would be able to necessarily respond to that in a timely fashion.
Well, 70% of these guys are Sultan.
I was just going to jump in and agree completely, Jason. We've got a couple of issues at the community bank side. One is the vast majority of them don't actually have CIOs, and they're average on spending 2-3% of their net interest expense on technology versus these larger ones that spend, you know, into the double digits. So you have a massive resource allocation differential between those two community banks, the community banks and the larger banks in the U.S. On top of that, you have these ridiculous contracts that a lot of the core providers are forcing the community banks on. I mean, average integrator to fighter, it's just ridiculous. And then the expenses are just through the roof. And so you have a resource issue coupled with the risk issue that's already been discussed. And then you have a contractual structure that makes it almost impossible for them to move, or if they do, they have to pay off the entire value of the contract. It puts that kind of standard deviations of normal community banks in the United States at an incredible disadvantage, even if they want to move in this space.
Yeah, and upwards of 70% of those community banks don't have their own core system. They're renting it from a vendor, so they're at the mercy of that vendor. So, absolutely what you say, Sultan. But listen, guys, we're going to take a quick break. Jason, do you want to take us out to break?
Yeah, well, when we come back, we're going to dig into, at first, what Neocova's approach from first principles on how they're approaching core banking. And we're going to have both Santo and Penny weighing in terms of where they see the future of this really core issue as it comes to the future of banking. And with that, let's take it to break.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
The Voice America Live Events Channel is here now to showcase your corporate, individual, or organization's live event. Visit voiceamerica.com/live events to see all of our past live events and find out more. Whether it's a multi-day conference, special speaker, or a single-day event, we've got everything to make your event a success. We can do a few hours or a few days. For more information about taking your event to the next level, call Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or email info@voiceamerica.com. Again, that's Jeff Spinard at 480-294-6417 or send us an email to info@voiceamerica.com. Voice America is where you are and where you want to be. Join us around the globe as we broadcast live from some of the most interesting events available. Don't forget to view all our live events, including on-demand access to past events that you may have missed by visiting voiceamerica.com/live events.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Yes, you can join the conversation, hashtag Breaking Banks or at Breaking Banks 1. You can also tweet Jason or I, and I'm sure you guys know that our Twitter handle's off by heart, but it's at Brett King and at Jason Hendricks. Now, before we get to the continued discussion on the core systems, there was some other very big news this week, which was, Matrix 4 has been announced. Did you see that, Jason?
Oh, come on. You think I'm going to mix something as exciting as Matrix 4? I came running in with this big grin on my face, and my wife's like, you clearly just saw that Matrix 4 is announced. And she just did this big sigh of like, yes, you'll be forced to watch it with me and pretend you're enjoying it.
Yes. So we know that Carrie Ann Moss and Keanu Reeves have both signed up for Matrix 4. Real question is, what it will be about. Now, if you guys watched the last show, the architect and the Oracle had a little debate about whether Neo would be back, and so it sounds like the debate is over. So it'll be really interesting to see the news about that as it comes out. Next year is going to be a huge year for movies, because isn't Avatar 2 coming out next year as well?
I miss that Avatar 2 is coming out, but it's just not as exciting as it is Matrix. Although, I mean, you know, Matrix
brings only up the highest selling movie of all time until Avengers Endgame took it out. But we'll see.
Yeah, but maybe I just don't have the affinity for it because I went in to go see it in the 3D and ended up getting very, very ill. And
oh, really?
Yeah, it did not sit well with me.
You haven't tried the 3D Avatar ride at Disney World then in Florida?
I have not, but I will be cool down there for the ABA conference, so maybe I will check that out next. But I wanted to bring up one of the interesting things out of the Matrix, because something you and Ms. Metaverse and Dave Birch always are pushing is, what can we actually learn from sci-fi? And it is interesting to see from an augmentation point of view as well as an AI point of view. If you think back to Matrix 1, some of the things that seem so far-fetched actually are a lot closer to reality. And tying this back to the conversation about core, one of the places I see the greatest disadvantage if you are stuck on an old core system, if you don't have access to your data and it has not been cleaned up and you can't begin to process it in real time, the ability to take advantage of these advances just puts you at such a disadvantage from both an experience and a cost perspective.
Right, because even if you have Elon Musk's Neuralink, it's not going to help you, right?
Yeah, not going to help you at all. But I think that brings us to Niyakova. And Sultan, excited to have you here. And would love for you to first share, what's your vision? Because you are about as passionate about core banking as anyone else that I've spoken to, and you're actually doing something about it. What are the principles from an approach architecturally that Neocova is built on?
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for giving me this opportunity to talk about something that I think interests everyone on this podcast and everyone listening and very few other people probably. But
fair enough.
But the basic issue is about 3.5 years ago, we came back and did a survey of the market and looked at all the different players, all the different technology platforms, and realized that they just had no connection with what modern technology looked like. You know, they weren't API first. They didn't have artificial intelligence built in. They didn't have both structured and unstructured data storage built in. They didn't have strong cybersecurity wrappers wrapped around them. And so for the last 3.5 years, we've been building a technology platform and a company that does all of that. And we said, what is the best technology we can find that we can then layer all of the important functionality of a core banking system on top of? So everything from client management to deposit loan product management, a GL. And then we started adding things like artificial intelligence and an identity management layer, core integrations with a lot of the standard things that everybody wants to connect to, clearinghouse, early warning for Zelle, et cetera, et cetera. And for us, it was about building a low-cost platform, so we're running on the cloud, that has all the basic functionality that can be delivered at a low cost with a very simple one-year contract, while at the same time opening up innovation for things like artificial intelligence, for things like better cybersecurity. You know, one of the things we did is we put multi-factor authentication into the platform from day one. And there are a lot of banks out there that don't do that. There are a lot of banking platforms that don't even encrypt PII. Well, that's all built into the system. And I'm excited to be able to talk more about it with you guys. But that's where we started from, and we've been building it for a few years now.
Can you talk about, what influences you've taken from things like blockchain and, how some of the neobanks are sort of building their sort of middleware layer-based cores rather than, a traditional core?
Absolutely. So, before doing this, I was working on some aid programs in Europe and in Africa, and then some banking products in Europe, and looking at what they were doing in terms of open banking, and realized that that is absolutely the future. On the blockchain side, because we focus predominantly on the U.S. market, we've kind of kept a little bit of blockchain distance just because, we've been working with the U.S. federal regulatory community for about 2 years now. And there's a lot of education that we have to do on basic things like artificial intelligence, strong cybersecurity, and blockchain, for the most part, is a distraction to that conversation. Rarely do we get in our sales pipeline a community bank or even one of the larger banks saying, well, can you use, Bitcoin or one of the other pseudo cryptocurrencies on this kind of platform? But there is a tremendous amount of innovation happening around the system. And for us,
We're losing you there, Sultan.
I apologize, guys. I'm actually in a construction site for our new office, and apparently the Wi-Fi isn't that
great. It's still being constructed.
Yes, it is.
Penny, in terms of your sort of view of the U.S. market, particularly the community banks, we've heard some rumors about credit unions and community banks coming together. And of course, Jason and JP have put together, FinTech Forge for part of this purpose. But for some of this new functionality that we're starting to see demand for, things like what we've seen released on the Apple, credit card, with the categorization engine and things like that, which are things that typically wouldn't be a part of a traditional core system. Are you starting to see more collaboration between various banks to sort of look at some of these solutions, or is it still going to wait on the core systems provider?
Oh, sure. Yeah, as you said, there have been a few groups forming. The ABA also has a group. And they've actually given some love to FinVact, which is a company that was set up by Frank and Mike Sanchez. And that system was actually co-developed by Live Oak Bank. So yeah, I think what people are looking for and hoping for is the best of both worlds. They want a high test system that's been proven to work to handle all of the daily transactions that happen in a bank. It could be thousands to millions of transactions per day, but they also want that that ability to run in the cloud, if that's their preference, that ability to work with APIs and bring in innovative products. They are looking for, I think they're looking for that group support because, you know, I think as we were saying, there's a lot of fear in going to a new core. So I think that idea of banding together and, you know, instead of each bank going through all of the due diligence and all of the vendor management work, you know, try to combine forces and maybe do it as a whole, or maybe one does it for the group. There have been a couple of groups like that where they're pooling their vendor management efforts. Yeah. So, yeah, that's definitely an interesting trend, and it makes a lot of sense, too.
I think the issue you bring up about cloud is also really critical because, you know, in China, one of the things that we've seen there is a big shift to, you know, components being in the cloud, not just because it's cloud, but because actually, you know, in China, you know, when you have these massive cloud systems like AliCloud, and of course AWS in the US is the equivalent, or, you know, Microsoft. Cloud environment as well. You know, they're now proving to be even safer than traditional on-premise systems that traditional banks have, because they're always hammered with you know, attacks in the cloud. So, you know, Sultan or Santo, do either of you guys have a comment about that aspect?
Oh, absolutely. I agree completely. I mean, the Google, Azure, and AWS environments in the U.S. are head and shoulders more secure than what we see, especially in the community banking space. I actually just gave this speech at the G7 a few weeks ago, and there's a massive misunderstanding among so many people in the financial services sector that the cloud environments are significantly more secure, even at the central bank level. And we can't get that information out more powerfully. I can walk into almost any bank that we're working with right now and probably walk out with a hard drive with unencrypted data on it. I can't do that on the Google Cloud environment, for example. There's just no way to do that.
Yeah. Funny story back to the Perk Street days, and Brett, I think you'll get a laugh out of this because move-in was just shortly after. We were meeting with a regulator, I won't name which one because I thankfully have a good relationship with that agency now. And we were a 7-person startup, right? And they didn't understand how we were possibly hosting things, not our core, but a lot of our other data on AWS. And the regulator looked at me and she goes, "Amazon? Like where I buy my toilet paper?" And she goes, she didn't think it could possibly be secure. And all I could think is, if you think a 7-person startup can do as well as Amazon can, right, and their co-location, you're crazy, lady.
AWS, which contributed $19 billion to Amazon's revenue line last year, I think we can all agree it's a little bit more than selling toilet paper these days. But
well, can I just say that if it's good enough for the CIA, it might be good enough for a community bank in
Indeed. Yeah.
Well, and in all fairness, they can get me my toilet paper faster than the Fed can settle an ACH. Just saying.
There is a through line in both of these conversations, and that really has to do with talent, right? The idea that certainly mid-sized institutions are banding together, and we're certainly seeing a lot of that in the credit union space in the U.S., and also the idea that, you know, more and more of the infrastructure needs to be outsourced and value creation needs to happen in other ways, you know, is front and center in terms of all of these institutions' ability to attract and retain talent. And yeah, so I think that is another key driver here to all of these things.
That's an excellent point. I mean, we see it in all of the institutions we talk to. They always have open jobs on the are always struggling to fill them, especially on the technology and cybersecurity fronts. It's an ongoing conversation.
Penny, I'm curious, what are you hearing from the talent perspective as it relates to technology, you know, from the banking sector? You know, once upon a time in the financial crisis, I saw a poll that bankers rated less on the trust scale with U.S. consumers than used car salesmen. You know, is it appealing? You know, are you hearing anything from banks and how they approach their tech talent?
They do struggle. Obviously, it's not as exciting to go work at, you know, First Bank of Nebraska as it is to work at Google or Facebook. And, you know, they're not having an easy time, attracting the best and the brightest. They do a lot of things to try to do that. Some of them are trying to create career paths for people, like data scientists and developers, to say, here, if you come here, you could eventually become a CIO. There's a path for you, and a lot of them are starting to do more like in-house education. Like Bank of America has a whole global tech and ops university, and they've actually begun telling their managers that they have to fill a certain number of positions from in-house. So it's kind of like you've got to deal with what you have. You can't keep going out. You know, train the people you have to do the jobs of the future, because you really just can't keep going to the external world all the time, and maybe we don't need to. But it's definitely a challenge. And I think, yes, that's part of wanting to use cloud services. And it's also part of, I think, some banks using more open source software, because some of the best developers, I think, like some of the open source platforms. So if people are used to working in, you know, say a Red Hat environment, you know, being able to offer that can be a benefit. And they also the banks try to give the argument that you're helping people with their lives. You know, this is, money is very important to people. It's a big cause of stress. So if you come here, you can really have a day-to-day impact on people. If you create a tool that helps somebody save better, you know, you're really going to change their life. So, and they're trying to work with like community groups too, to try to, like in South Carolina, there's a group where they're trying to help people in the community get trained to do some of these jobs and place them in jobs within the banks. But competing with Silicon Valley is next to impossible for these companies.
So I'll tell you what's happened. Again, I'll go back to China, but obviously you guys know I love, you know, talking about China's the disruption as a result of the tech giants out there. But the largest challenger bank in the world, of course, is WeBank, which now has over 125 million customers. That's more than JP Morgan's retail business. But what's really interesting about that, and they're valued at $21 billion recently, which is about the same as SpaceX, to give you sort of a view of that. But what's interesting is they have a lot of blockchain stuff. They built their core in the cloud from scratch. It's a real-time core. It's extremely impressive seeing what is happening there. But at least five regional banks or community-type banks in China now have adopted their core system. WeBank started to sell that to other banks in China, which I think is a really interesting move.
Yeah, very interesting. True banking as a service, not just the back end regulatory, but true technology. Sultan, I'm curious. You know, you're sitting across the table from a lot of these banks. What talent, you know, as banks are rethinking, you know, they might not need a CIO to start, but what talent should a bank, you know, from the smaller to the larger, should they be thinking about adding to their team as they prepare for digitization?
So, man, that's a great question. I wish some of these guys would be asking me that. But the two that jump out to me, and the two that I can't push hard enough, is some sort of cybersecurity specialist, number one. And number two is someone who really understands digital product management. I don't think a lot of bankers in the United States, unlike what we might have seen, for example, with the China, the WeBank example, understand that they're selling digital products and services, even if they're still worrying about checks and traditional, you know, ink and acid-based check fraud, which is still a thing. That's just a huge issue, and that's the way. That's how they're going to be competitive, is to understand that that's how Bank of America, Chase, et cetera, are eating their lunch right now. The cybersecurity issue is just massive. You know, our informal survey says that half of all banks have unencrypted PII sitting around, and that's just intolerable. And that's got to be fixed, because we're only starting to get the first cracks of how bad these cybersecurity issues for these especially mid-sized institutions are going to become over time.
Santo, how do you think the mid-size up to the larger banks should be responding? The ones who don't have the plethora of resources, you know, how should they be responding to this? Whether should they be bringing that talent in-house? Should they be growing that talent? Should they be buying that talent? How should they approach it?
If a CEO of one of these banks said, what's the first thing I should do? What's the first person I should hire?
Well, I think part of it is decide who you are, right? You know, what, especially if you're mid-size, what's your niche, what's your differentiation, and move your way out from there, I think, is part of the answer. Certainly, as Sultan said, if you're delinquent in security talent, you've got to cover that up. After that, then it becomes a question of, you know, what do you want to do? I've worked with a couple of institutions recently that, you know, they're absolutely, the CEO is absolutely committed to making sure that they're using their data appropriately. Now, great idea, long project, long time to get to a payoff, and, you know, difficult to keep their attention on it. It depends is always kind of a funny answer, but I do think part of that, when as I've met with bankers and creating executives over time, part of what I try and assess is, you know, where is it that you think you're differentiating yourself in your market? And then let's begin to think about how the technology can support that. So that's kind of the way I think about it, Jason.
You bring up an important point, though, which is your technology needs to be more strategic and a longer-term vision. If the technology from the large cores isn't a problem, their contracts really are a problem when you're locked in for 5 to 7 years, you know, and that really takes a bite out of you. Penny, as we're getting closer to the end here, what are your quick thoughts on, you know, how does a bank break itself from those long-term contracts and kind of unwind, you know, this big mess of technology and business that runs through the core?
Carefully. I think I don't know how you unwind from those contracts. I'm not sure that you do. I think if they sign those contracts, they are stuck. But I think part of the problem is, too, not only do they have the older core systems that are maybe 30, 40 years old, but they've also customized them over the years. So it really, and they've added on. So as you said, it really is this like spaghetti-like mess. And I think what we're seeing is that some of the banks that are doing this are doing it piece by piece. Like, let me put in a new mortgage system over here and then just make a link to what I have now. And then, you know, in a year, I'll do a new unsecured lending system or small business lending system. And then, you know, bit by bit, I think they're sort of breaking off these chunks and using modern technology for those. And then, like, the very last thing would be to unplug the very basic deposit-taking, transaction handling engine. That's my sense, is that they're trying to do it kind of gradually rather than rip everything out and try to replace it and then, you know, take the chance of an outage or something. But certainly the best practice would be to do it because these systems are getting older and older, and it's going to get harder and harder to, as someone said, stay relevant as the world keeps changing and tech competitors and challenger banks keep coming out with more interesting options. We're already seeing some market share being taken, especially in small business lending, in unsecured loans, and that's kind of eating into banks' credit card business. And, you know, so it's something they really have to do.
Yeah, it's something they have to do. And, you know, frequent contributor and resident snarketer Ron Shevlin, you know, brings out, you know, sometimes it's easy to miss because banks don't feel like they're losing customers. But Penny, you brought up this really important point. They're starting to lose some of the products that these customers had, right? And so you're left with a relationship, but the most important pieces of it, whether it be the credit card going to Apple or, you know, a loan from somebody else or the wealth management moving somewhere else, we're starting to see this, you know, kind of splitting up of where your transactions lie. You know, I was recently talking to a group of regulators and said, you know, who has a checking account with Amazon? And everyone was surprised and said, I didn't know they had a checking account. And said, who has a balance at Amazon? They're in the business. So I think we're talking about an important issue. Thank you to Penny for joining us as always. Santo and Sultan, would love to have you on again. And, you know, Brett, why don't you bring us home?
Yes, so we'll get to the heart of it, the very core of it. And that is that Breaking Banks is the number one podcast and radio show in the world on fintech. And we've been very happy to have you guys with us this week. We did our 300th episode just last week. We did a roundup with some of our frequent co-hosts sharing their favorite spots. You should check out the show if you haven't heard it from last week. It was a great show. But don't forget, if you like the show, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Tweet us out to your friends. Tell everyone about us. And don't forget, you can listen to all or more of the 300 shows in our back catalog, plus episodes from FinTech 5 with Jason Henrich, Serial Entrepreneur with JP Nichols, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. That's it for this week. We'll see you guys again next week for more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time for more of the latest in fintech news.